Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archives.
Shh, okay, it's Media Network. Yeah, Media Network, all right. Everybody stand back, I'm going to do it. Here we go. Let's start the programme. Uh-oh. Let's get out of here.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Marks. On July 12th, 2012, the BBC leaves Bush House for the last time, with a world news bulletin in English at 11 hours GMT. That iconic building on the Strand has been the home of the BBC World Service since 1941. There have been various tributes in BBC programmes on the network in the last few months. As a World Service listener since 1969, I've watched this organisation from the outside looking in. My fear is that these great stories of an intriguing building will get lost and separated in cyberspace as they gradually move down the vast archiving system in the BBC. It's already happening, as BBC World Service moves on to a new life and purpose in New Broadcasting House at the Langham, just by Oxford Circus. So I've simply combined what I've heard into one compilation in the hope that by putting it together, the context of these stories won't get lost. I note that most of the work has been done by Anna Horse Proporter. I hope the BBC commission her to finish the tribute site, because these stories must not get lost.
This is the BBC World Service. And now for Your World, John Tusa presents Goodbye to Bush House.
Floor 5. 欢迎登录 BBC Chinese.com.
Kung para sa ra BBC House sa labaran dunia dero hotel ng
sa. I love this building, every bit of it. I loved it from the very first moment I entered the building. The only thing I was unhappy about were the carpets. They were worn out, with a lot of holes, very undignified. And I thought, my God, such a beautiful building, such a fantastic organization, such awful carpets.
I remember the first three golden rules that Mr. Rentoul told me when he accepted me for the job. Everywhere where you put a comma, you put a full stop now, because this is radio. The second one, whatever your political beliefs, leave them outside on the hanger with your coat when you come into the studio. And the third one, don't sit down at a clean table in the canteen because it's just been wiped with a smelly rag.
This is London.
I still remember, after listening to the BBC, my dad would remind me, don't tell anybody. You'd be in a deep trouble. You could be put in jail.
Ici, non. Les Français parlent au français. Honneur et patrie.
The sounds and smells of the past. Nostalgic, of course, but real too. Could we get more real than listening to London in the darkest years of Nazi-occupied Europe? There was General de Gaulle, the voice of defiance. Only 5 minutes a day for 4 war years, but what a lifeline. Not only for France, Europe listened to the BBC's international broadcast as well. Why? Because it was a BBC principle. If we broadcast news about our defeats, they'll believe news of our victories. In 1941, the BBC External Services had moved to Bush House in central London after a bomb fell on Broadcasting House. In a few months' time, the BBC World Service, as it now is, moves back to its first home again and will join the rest of BBC News. The broadcasts won't change, nor will the World Service's values of truth, impartiality, objectivity. Those are the BBC's values. But the place will change, and it's funny how organisations become part of their building. World Service, Bush House, inseparable. Until now. What is it about the place?
I don't know whether it's just the physical building, the bricks and mortar of Bush House, or the fact that we have a sort of United Nations of
broadcasting here, but I think maybe it's a bit of both. It's not a bespoke broadcasting centre, and that's part of its charm. It's a rabbit warren of corridors and crazy modifications and things, and that's part of what makes it special, I think.
I'm John Tusa, and you're listening to the first part in the series Goodbye to Bush House. I'm outside the main doors of Bush House, and I used to walk through them every day when I was managing director here in the 1980s. And what doors they are. Huge columns. And as you come in, you've got marble floors. You've got brass. It's a spectacular building, but it was also something much more workaday, because this was the home of the BBC World Service. At its peak, the World Service broadcast a 24-hour English language network, as well as up to 44 foreign language services, transmitting programmes to their target audiences, everything from Finnish to Bengali, all around the world. And not just news. Programmes could be about science, music, the arts, dramas. They were all made here as well. Editorially, no one told the BBC what to say. Oh, a few listeners might have carped, but most just trusted their ears. So, who kept it on air for those 1,200 hours each week? Bush House's legendary SMs, the studio managers. Among them, Jonathan Kempster, then Giles Booth.
You would come in and maybe you would record a Hindi dawn talk, then an Arabic drama, then you might do radio newsreel. So we did actually work across the board, and it was an incredibly exciting and interesting place to work.
Did they behave differently? Were they?
They did, yes, very much so. I mean, the worst time was working in the Arabic service during Ramadan, because everyone was on a short fuse.
Some of the language sections were very, very small, and you'd be working with people whose, not only did you not understand their language, but you couldn't even read their script. You had to communicate in a completely different way. They would use hand signals, so everything would be done. They would point to you when they wanted you to play a tape, and they'd have a series of gestures that you learned to understand, to interpret what they wanted you to do technically to the programme, whether you wanted to fade something down or bring it back up.
Surprisingly few mistakes were made, but on the night shift, that was when mistakes were made. And in those days, the mixing desks had a 24-way selector switch to select whichever network you were transmitting to. And you had one selector for the studio monitoring for the presenters and one selector for your cubicle monitoring for the studio manager. And it was very easy to be slightly out on the two of them. And I remember doing the Somali transmission, and afterwards the producer came to me looking a bit concerned and said, what was going wrong? What was the problem? I said, what problem? He said, well, I was hearing Tamil in my headphones. So I've been apologising every 5 minutes to say to the listeners, I'm sorry if you're hearing the Tamil service. This is the Somali service. We're terribly sorry. And I said, well, no, I just got the monitoring switched wrongly, I'm afraid. BBC.
Bush House, the whole BBC World Service, was always about voices, people, the humanity of the broadcaster's voice, nowhere more so than in the language services. Why trust the Somali service, for instance? Because Abdullahi Haji has been speaking to his listeners from London for more than 50 years. In the 1980s, the service faced closure. Enter its defenders.
Fortunately, there were a group of lords, House of Lords, who served in British Somaliland during the British colonial rule, and they said, you want to cut the Somali service over our dead body? And then the London Times wrote an editorial saying that there are three things that the Somalis love dearly. Number one, Islam. Number two, themselves, because they are slightly egotistical. Number three, they like the BBC Somali service.
It has been unchallengeable since, especially as Somalia has slid deeper into ungovernability. Through it all, in hard times and less hard times, Abdullahi Haji's voice has stayed true. Some say he's better known in East Africa than the Queen.
I don't know about that. Sometimes it was scary, you know. You walk in the middle of Djibouti Republic or Addis Ababa, and the people will call you, Haji, how are you? It was with trepidation and also with happiness, you know, that I was recognized by everybody, really. Whenever they talked to me, they said, I have your photograph, you know, on my bedroom. You know, every morning when I wake up, I look at you and I say, that is Haji.
Small service or large one, all the BBC's language services have much in common. Why do their listeners listen? Because they need to know. What do the language services provide? All the information that listeners can't get from their own stations at home. Take the years of communism, the Cold War. The Iron Curtain kept the political cold in, accurate news, out. This was part of Yuri Goligorsky's childhood.
The first BBC broadcast was at 6:45 in the morning, Moscow time, which meant that at 6:40, my father would be already on his toes, tuning up. At the time when it wasn't jammed, were the best time of our lives.
Did you occasionally have friends in to listen as well?
Never with friends, just with my dad, with my father. And then after the broadcast, there will be long hours of discussion of various points made in the broadcast, and why did they say this, and why did they say that, and what did they actually mean, and how it's going to affect our lives. So perhaps 15-minute broadcast and two-hour-long discussion afterwards.
So intellectually, well, spiritually, what effect did it have, particularly on your father?
That gave a glimmer of hope. We never thought that we were cut off, and that's something which the Soviet regime was unable to stop.
So one flagship service in English, up to 45 in a Babel Tower of other languages. They all had to broadcast to the same BBC standards, in the same tone of voice, avoiding propaganda, putting the listeners' needs first. But how could we be sure? The core was the central newsroom of Bush House. They decided what was news, how it was written, what events mattered. No language service, English or any other, could deviate. Mary Rain.
Sometimes editors could be quite rigid and insist that you follow absolutely blindly. And I remember being once in charge of African bulletins, Smalley's. The Pope had died, so did I put that number one in the bulletin? I went and argued, look, unless I say the Imam of Rome, it won't mean anything to them. So you could get a few tensions of that nature. We had a magnificent technical facility called the Lamps and Tubes. And what would do is you would roll this piece of paper, somebody would stamp the word, let's say Hungarian, I was sending it to the Hungarian service, then I would ring them up, say, I'm sending you the new story on, let's say, floods in China, put it in this, and then whoosh, and it went in a tube to the far ends of the building.
And who were the BBC's broadcasters? If exiles or émigré, weren't they bound to be biased? If recruits from the target country, could they be relied on to be impartial? David Wedgwood-Benn, head of the Yugoslav service in the mid-1970s, faced this dilemma very openly.
We kept on good terms with the Tito regime. With their help, we were able to recruit Yugoslav citizens to work here, which was a good thing from our point of view, because it saved the place from having an émigré atmosphere.
Did they ever try to infiltrate somebody who really was not a journalist?
I think they did it many years ago in the early 1950s when the system came into force, yes, but not in my time.
Was it as simple as that? Eastern Europe in the Cold War was a complex, duplicitous and suspicious place. Maya Samolov, who worked in the Yugoslav service before it broke up.
I once heard Bush House in the Cold War years described as a sort of a place with institutional green paint on the walls and various East Europeans and Russians walking down the corridors smoking rank cigarettes and muttering to each other conspiratorially. And that sort of is what it was like. I mean, the place was a fog of smoke. Everybody smoked. And there was a lot of conspiracy going on. But the wonderful thing was that genuinely, unless I went through my 25 years at Bush House as a complete idiot, there wasn't really that much to spy on because we were in the business of broadcasting. We didn't have secret documents. The kind of things you needed to hide were information about recruitment and so on because it would link to families at home.
listeners around the world tuned in to the World Service, and so did their governments. Many hated what the BBC broadcast said about them. They'd ring up and complain to the British ambassador, "Didn't the British government pay for the World Service? Tell them to stop." As British Foreign Secretary, Sir Malcolm Rifkind got used to that.
Well, they said that, and they to some degree believed that, but they were also aware that the BBC tended to be reliable, that if it presented information of a political kind, it did not automatically follow the views of the government of the day. There were a legion of examples when the BBC World Service would be publicising issues which the government might have preferred them not to. There would always be some scepticism whether at the end of the day the British government could not impose its will on the World Service. I actually think there were grave limits to the extent to which the government could do that, but the wider world would not have been aware of that.
If the government of the day exerted no censorship on the news from Bush House, Donald Armour, who worked in the German service, says there was a subtle form of self-censorship on occasion.
It was detectable, at least in the language services, that there was sometimes a tendency to downplay negative aspects of British life, especially during the worst of the troubles in Northern Ireland in the 1970s, when Britain, unfortunately, was condemned by the European Court of Human Rights for torture of prisoners. And I sometimes gained the feeling that there were some in Bush House who did not properly appreciate that self-criticism, far from undermining Britain's position and reputation, only enhances it. A German producer referred to the German expression die Schere im Kopf, which means the scissors in the head, a form of self-censorship.
So, broadcasting accurate news was one thing, but did the World Service actually topple over into interfering in local politics? During the 1979 Iranian Revolution, even the British ambassador in Tehran was critical of the BBC Persian Service's reporting of the growing opposition to the Shah.
گزارش کردن انقلاب سال 1357 در ایران برای بخش فارسی BBC چالشی بزرگ بود. سانسور رسانه‌های داخلی در ایران.
Back in London, Lotfali Konji remembers how the BBC Persian Service broadcasters judged their programs at the time.
I would say that it reflected what was happening on the ground. The Shah's regime happened to be the losing side. If you report objectively, without taking sides, you invariably help the winning side. That is how I would put it. In that sense, BBC Persian broadcasts did help the revolution.
Within pro-Shah Iranian emigre circles in London, the belief that the BBC Persian service had caused the revolution was very general. Shadab Vajdi, wife of Lotfali.
Months after that, in any gathering me and my husband went, people are talking, oh, these are the people who did that, this and that. They look at us like, British spies or something. But I don't think that I'm guilty of doing something in the BBC because of reporting what was going on. I don't feel guilty.
Inevitably, controversy has never been far away. If the World Service is supposed to broadcast in the national interest, what happens when the government dislikes what the BBC says? Take the Falklands War in 1982. One incident in a distant war, but there were two accounts of it. Sir Malcolm Rifkind had a grandstand view.
There was that extraordinary occasion when the BBC World Service was reporting some dogfight between British fighter aircraft and Argentinian aircraft. And the report from the World Service said that the Argentinian side claimed that X had happened, and the British claimed that Y had happened, implying there was a sort of equivalence as to the reliability of a military junta's claims and that of a democratically elected government. That would have been bad enough coming from anyone, but coming from the BBC when Britain was at war inevitably caused quite a lot of criticism, not just in government circles, but in the wider public. I happen to think that the World Service was right, but that's another matter.
The British government has announced a total blockade of the Falkland Islands, including an air blockade, starting on Friday.
Force has been used. It's been used against our territory, against our people.
They're under attack again.
During the Falklands campaign, the BBC Latin American service faced a classic challenge to its impartiality. Britain calls the islands the Falklands, the Argentines, the Islas Malvinas. What would the BBC Latin American service say? Julia Zapata was there.
We used to call it Las Islas Falklands or Malvinas, always. A mouthful, I know, but it was like that in every single bulletin, in every single programme. And initially they made fun of us in Argentina. But after a while, it was very widely respected as a kind of hallmark of the BBC.
It was a desperately emotional time for the BBC's Latin American broadcasters. Everyone hated the Argentine military junta. And yet...
The Argentine colleagues were getting phone calls from their mothers in tears saying, why are you still working there? There is a war. I remember, for instance, one night we got a phone call from the chaplain with the Argentine forces, and he phoned us up to say, if you could see them, these are terrified boys, conscripts that have been brought down from the mountains. Please, please do something. And I remember our colleagues from Argentina coming off the air. They held it together, of course, but then coming off the air and bursting into tears. And I think what happened is that the studio managers started communicating with others around the building about how difficult it was for us. And so people started arriving in the studio. We had to come off the air, I think it was 11:30, with cakes and coffees, and they wouldn't talk about the war. They were there to make us feel better and to make us feel supported. So I could still get quite choked up about it. And actually, on the positive note, I met my husband in one of these after-transmission coffees, and we've been married all these many years, so something good came of that.
Bush House was filled with stories like that. Broadcasting in a crisis, that was special. Broadcasting in the hour of need. Take Burma in 1988. Take a young reporter, Chris Gunnis. Send him into Burma illegally on a tourist visa. What happens?
Shortly after I got there, because Ne Win resigned and because the whole anti-government protest started, all of the hotel workers were on the side of freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of information. It was a wonderfully liberating feeling for a young BBC cub reporter.
Can you tell me, what is the organisation you claim to represent?
We represent all Burma University Students Democratic League.
And when was that formed? And
exhilarating for Chris Gunnis, great for the students, but did he ever think he was interfering politically?
Not at all. And to even to begin to buy into that argument is to buy into what the junta put about. The junta basically said, here was the BBC producing a revolution in Burma. I ask you, could a 20-something-year-old cub reporter from the BBC Eastern Service really overthrow or somehow foment a nation to rise up?
But in one interview, Burmese students seized the initiative and used the BBC to get at their political message.
Well, here I'm afraid I think we probably are guilty of reporting on the future. In one of the interviews I did at Rangoon University, one of them had the foresight to say that at 8 minutes past 8 on the 8th of the 8th of the 88th, there would be the beginnings of a national strike. Because the BBC had announced this after months and months of very reliable reporting, Burmese people knew that was the time. And sure enough, I was on the phone to Burma at 8 minutes past 8 on the 8th of the 8th of the 88th. And yes, the revolution started.
The BBC World Service lived through and grew through the years of fascism and the Second World War, through the years of communism and the Cold War. In 1989, communism collapsed. The world changed. How did the BBC adapt as other international broadcasters fell away? That is the next part of our story. As the World Service gets ready to leave Bush House and move into its new home with the rest of the BBC, it's time to talk of the most important part of its makeup, how it speaks to its listeners. No listeners, no broadcasting. It's as simple as that. There's no better example of the intense link with the audience than two programmes, Network Africa and Focus on Africa. So powerful were they, especially in the 1980s, that young broadcasters such as Elizabeth Ohini resented their influence.
In my own home, Ghana, and in many other African countries that I knew of, it irritated me a lot that people tuned in to the BBC to hear what was happening in their own countries. And this was deeply hurtful to me. And my pride took a terrible beating about that. I had a great difficulty with myself about whether I should be part of this.
But you soon got used to that.
I soon got used to that. And in a way, I was happy that at least they did have some avenue for finding out exactly what was happening in their own country.
Focus on Africa is something extraordinary. A voice for the whole continent, yet also at times almost a local radio as well. Take Boxing Day 1989. Elizabeth Ohini was on duty with her editor Robin White. The phone rang. It was a man called Charles Taylor.
We didn't know who Charles Taylor was. Nobody knew that he had invaded Liberia. That was the first time. And Robin White interviewed him. But in Liberia, it soon developed into how Liberians heard about the progress of the war. So at 1706 GMT, the war will come to a temporary end and both sides would stop and listen to Focus to find out what was happening and such. Inside Focus itself, huge arguments developed about, are we giving too much airing to Charles Taylor or are we not?
We are not there to negotiate anything. We were invited by ECOWAS and we are there to listen to what they have to say, Robin.
If they call for a ceasefire, will you abide by that?
No, there will be no ceasefire, Robin. No ceasefire.
Robin White, editor of Focus on Africa, who then spoke regularly to the pushy, manipulative Charles Taylor.
I think he did use us, and he was remarkably skillful at using it. The interesting thing about Charles Taylor, he was actually very rarely on our airtime, but he was such a fantastic performer. You can say what you like about Charles Taylor, and he was a pretty ghastly person, but boy, could he talk. Some people in Liberia think that we made their life worse by putting him on the air.
And on balance, looking back on it, what do you think?
I think there's no way that we could have told the story without interviewing him.
Did you have to say to yourselves, we know that what we're doing probably wouldn't be done like this if it was World Service English, mainstream?
I think we did feel that. I mean, for instance, at the time, you know, we might have been broadcasting about the Angolan Civil War, for instance. The World Service would be banging on about the Polish meat ration or something like that. And I'm sure at the time the Polish meat ration was crucial to the collapse of communism, but it seemed to us to be very small beer compared to the havoc that was being wreaked in Africa.
I mean, did you ever feel that you were not being fully impartial?
Well, probably yes, because if you were living in Africa, all you heard was the government day after day after day on your radio station. So I kind of felt it was our job to fill in the other half that people, Africans, were not hearing.
And that was why audiences listened and why politicians wanted to appear on Focus on Africa to communicate with them. In March 1989, the British Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, was about to tour Malawi, Morocco and Nigeria. Elizabeth Ohini arrived at Downing Street in her finest Ghanaian cloth and her most combative BBC manner.
Halfway through it, she turns round to me and says, is there anything pleasant you can think of to ask me? And I think I thought of something to say, I think, like about food or something. But then we just went back to, because there were so many things we had to ask her. Our listeners were full of things every day about what British government policy towards Africa was. So we felt we had a responsibility to ask all these questions. But when it finished, then I couldn't find my umbrella. And Mrs. Thatcher suddenly was transformed into a hostess, you know. And there she was on all fours trying to find my umbrella, which had gone under her chair. So she pulled out the umbrella for me and we thought we had ended on a good note. Except as we were walking out, her press secretary turns and says to us, you two have not done your favours or the BBC any favours, I can assure you. Throwing all those polemics at the Prime Minister, you can be sure that you would not be getting any interviews, nor the BBC, in a very, very long time.
It is totally absurd. I have frequently said to my fellow heads of government, sitting in a Commonwealth conference in a rather nice hotel, very well looked after, really I find it utterly repugnant that you should...
Not quite. Wherever she went in Africa on that trip, people told Margaret Thatcher that they had heard the interview and that she was magnificent. The mood in No. 10 changed. When the Berlin Wall fell in 1989 and communism collapsed, the World Service began to discover in greater detail the effect it had had on its listeners during the Cold War.
The top of this mechanical grabber is now just about to grab a big concrete pipe on the top of the Berlin Wall. And off it comes. The great applause of the crowd.
Of these, perhaps the most important was that architect of global change, the Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. In 1991, he fell victim to an attempted coup. Bridget Kendall was the BBC's Moscow correspondent.
At the time of the coup, most Soviet broadcasts were broadcasting the news of the emergency committee. So the BBC became an important point of listening, I think, for many people. And it turned out it did also for Mikhail Gorbachev, who'd been trapped in his dacha under house arrest when he refused to join the coup plotters. And I saw him this summer, actually, and he explained that he had a little Japanese radio, and his son-in-law, who was rather good at mechanics, had sort of fixed it, and they managed to get shortwave radio broadcasts on it. And they twiddled around to see what was there. And then he memorably, in the press conference when he came back to Moscow, said, "We heard the BBC best of all." In Russian, of course. They were listening to the Russian service of the BBC.
Ловили BBC лучше всего.
Everyone in the press conference said, "Where's the BBC correspondent? She should ask a question." But actually, I'd already left because I'd gone back to the bureau to file.
Everyone remembers those days. Everyone remembers that the whole history, not just of the Soviet Union, but of the world, could have gone in a very different direction if the attempt to neuter Gorbachev had succeeded. And the World Service was one of the reasons why he was able to retain contact with what was happening on the wider scene.
The former British Foreign Secretary, Sir Malcolm Rifkind. That was not the only occasion that World Service journalism took centre stage on the world scene. During the First Gulf War in 1991, tensions about the role of the World Service were especially acute. The rulers of Saudi Arabia in particular were very sensitive to every word, every tone of voice. Sam Younger was head of the BBC's Arabic service.
Their expectation, and very firmly expressed expectation, was that Britain was part of the coalition that was with them. Therefore, they would expect that any institution funded by the British government would also be with them. And they were therefore outraged whenever they heard an Iraqi voice, an interview from Baghdad, an interview of somebody sympathetic to the Iraqis from Jordan, for example. They were outraged and said this was bias and that Britain was part of the coalition and must act as part of the coalition as much through the BBC as any other way. So they certainly gave government grief, and the Foreign Office was always perfectly happy to pass on that grief to us, as properly they should.
Close internal scrutiny showed that there was no bias of the kind the Saudis alleged. But as the head of the newsroom, Bob Jobbins points out, there were anxieties among the wider audience.
I think that threw up some extremely interesting weaknesses in the way we tackled major stories. And a lot of attention in the Gulf War was focused on macro issues like whether we were reporting it in an objective way, were we doing it in a way which was inimical to the interests of, say, the Western powers, and so on. More interesting to me was that in the early days of the Gulf War, there was definitely an impression among some of our audiences that we were interested only in very narrow aspects of it. And there was quite a backlash from, for example, the Indian subcontinent, which said, "You've been going on and on and on about a number of Britons held hostage in Kuwait. There are millions of Indians and Pakistanis in terrible circumstances in the Gulf, and you haven't mentioned them once." We have big audiences in India. That's not very good, really, is it?
And we're back to that perennial problem, especially at times of crisis. World Service broadcasters were often speaking from London back to their home countries and people. Take Huda al-Rashid, a Saudi national. How hard was it for her to stay impartial?
Very difficult. But we were taught not to show our emotion and just be impartial of what we are reading. It didn't show, but maybe inside us, yes, to be frank.
Feelings, yes, but they had to be left at the studio door. What took over, according to a former Arabic service head, Eric Bowman, was editorial discipline.
About 50% of our staff were Palestinians. And they were living, their families were living with this.
But despite that, your Palestinian staff, were you always happy that they were absolutely straight down the line?
I think they understood the consequences of not being so. There had been Black September and the driving out of the Palestinians from Jordan. Yeah. And it was said that some of the announcers had a sort of metaphorical spit when they mentioned King Hussein's name. But I think that was stamped on pretty quickly.
Just occasionally, as when King Faisal of Saudi Arabia was assassinated in 1975, feelings couldn't be controlled. That was Huda al-Rashid's experience.
The news just came, like, suddenly. And I don't know, the BBC are very, very, they were very kind, because they let me just obligate the late king, saying, "Our king is dead, my king is dead." Just broadcasting Saudi songs, Quran. I was saying things about the late king, and my tears were out and coming, and the listeners could feel it. And I had letters from Saudi Arabia, how they were touched.
There's no doubt that the BBC's own correspondents in the field are a key link between the World Service and its listeners. Many have become legends, such as Mark Tully, throughout the Indian subcontinent. But with fame came personal danger.
I remember a time in Pakistan in the days of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto when the government was very angry with the BBC during the movement against Bhutto. And I was reporting his speech in Parliament in Islamabad, and I found the whole speech was an attack on me and on the BBC. And I didn't know what was going to happen to me, whether I was going to be arrested, carted out of the building, chucked out of Pakistan or what. But at the end, Bhutto screamed at the top of his voice, "But we are a generous nation, we are a generous nation, and we will not do anything to him." So I left, and as I went out there, my taxi driver sitting outside said, "My ears were burning," he said, "when I heard that speech," because he was able to hear it on the radio in his cab.
Some, indeed, have lost their lives, often the locally based reporters and stringers who brought the most dangerous news from the most difficult situations. Traditionally, the World Service's authority had come from British voices. But the time came for a different sound, a more diverse voice. Take the case of Zafar Abbas, now editor of Pakistan's leading newspaper Dawn, and for 16 years, the BBC correspondent in Islamabad.
The decision was that on the strength of my journalism, on the strength of my reporting, I should not be denied this chance of being a reporter or a correspondent for BBC just because my accent is not English or British. In the last few years, it was almost every day, and it was a big news out of Pakistan, war going on in Afghanistan, bombs going off in Pakistan. It was a huge story over here.
Before you were accepted, did you ever feel frustrated?
Well, there were lots of periods of frustration when I was asked to probably write a dispatch and record it, and when it was not used, me tuning into the BBC and waiting for my dispatch to be broadcast, and suddenly realized that some in-house reporter has rewritten the dispatch and it was broadcast. I used to hate those times. But yes, there was a lot of frustration in the initial years, but what happened in the following years really overcame everything, and it was great.
For Zafar, it was 9/11 which changed his reporting from Pakistan. Tish Golding remembers that day
working as she was in the newsroom of Bush House.
It's always very quiet and serious and committed, and it just quietly carries on, regardless almost of what's happening. But that day, when the first tower fell, I think was the only time I saw the newsroom erupt into noise and just suddenly lose it for no more than 30 seconds, I would say. But it was just kind of extraordinary uproar at what was an absolutely extraordinary event. And it just kind of it was a measure of the shock for everyone. And at that point, the senior duty editor that day, the person in charge of the newsroom, jumped up on the desk in a very un-Bush House-like way and just said, right, everybody, just calm down. This is a major story and this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it.
The BBC was called the sixth prayer in Afghanistan. I mean, the Muslims pray five times, and they used to call the BBC the sixth prayer. And it was a must to listen to the evening programme in Pashto. This was just an absolute must.
Listening to the wireless as personal observance, that was part of it too. Najiba Khazrai came to work for the Pashto service in 1992. 9 years later, NATO went into Afghanistan. One morning, a call came from No. 10 Downing Street. The Prime Minister, Tony Blair, wanted to be interviewed.
They've done their bit of a homework and realised that the BBC Pashto service was very prominent in Afghanistan. And if you want to pass a message to Afghans, that's the way to do it. Obviously, my job was not to give him a free hand and make the interview a little bit more difficult.
So what sort of questions did you put to him?
Well, one of the questions was, why now? Why now you're going to Afghanistan? And I said, you're doing this now because something happened in the United States and you have to go and find an enemy. You know, you have to create an enemy and say, well, that's the... And when I brought back the interview, one of my colleagues from the newsroom said to me, Najiba, we don't speak like this to our prime minister, because I was, you know, I was... First of all, I forgot my English in the beginning of the interview. My hands were shaking, and then in the middle, I found my courage, and then I was saying, but hold on a second, wait a second, wait a minute, wait a minute. And...
How did he take it?
Well, he said, after every single question, that's a very good question. And he was full of promises, and he said, we will not walk out of Afghanistan this time.
And it's not just about politics, diplomacy and the great issues of the world. Talking to listeners, especially in war-ravaged Afghanistan, demanded a human response. Faced with countless letters about Afghan children who had lost friends, relations, even limbs, Najiba became a storyteller, disguising her voice as a cartoon rabbit.
کیسه د میکروب ده میکروب یو داسې بلا ده یو داسې بلا ده چې خدای دې هر څوک ځنی وساتي
غته بلا ده ما خولي.
I wrote a story about a little girl who lost her mother, and she lost her will to wash her face and brush her hair. And then she sees this image of her mother in her dream. And the mother says, well, I'm still there, I'm still watching you, and I want you to brush. So the next morning she wakes up, the first thing she does, she starts brushing her hair. So it's kind of a step to a right direction.
And did people think the rabbit was real?
Yes, 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 yes. My colleague went to Kabul. He came back and he said, Najiba, this big Taliban commander came to me and he said in my ears, who is this rabbit? Is the little girl? How old is she?
70 years, so many words, so many listeners, so many events. A world transformed not just once, but several times. Huge changes also in the way the World Service broadcasts to our audience, with online and FM stations reinforcing shortwave and the launch of Persian and Arabic television. You can't sum up the experience of the BBC World Service's existence and history in a few words. Now it goes to a new home and new colleagues within the BBC. The former head of World Service News, Bob Jobbins, allows himself some cautious optimism.
Well, I'd start from the premise that the building didn't make the BBC, that, OK, it's iconic and all the rest of it. For broadcasting, it's always been extremely problematic. So one part of me is always saying, what kept you? What are we still doing here? We should have been out ages ago. The issue is not, should we be integrated? It's how World Service should be integrated and how the advantages should be shared.
But a sense of farewell is inevitable. Remarkable broadcasts came from Bush House. History was seen, reported, recorded, and sometimes made. The memories are in this building, and what memories it holds. But they're also part of the World Service, wherever it broadcasts from.
You can't turn your back on that, and you don't have to. So as I walk out of these great, great doors, with their wonderful columns and portals, probably for the last time, and as everybody working at Bush House will walk out of them for the last time in only a few months, I'll leave you with the reflections of some of the people who made Bush House and the World Service what it is and what it has been.
As a working environment, nothing special. As a place, near the Temple, near Lincoln's Inn Field, near Covent Garden, near Somerset House, near the Thames, it is unspeakably wonderful.
It'll be a very sad day in lots of ways. I've spent most of my BBC career here, and actually I met my husband here in Bush House. There's something about the history of this place, I think, that will stay with us, and I'm glad to have just been part of it, really.
I was saying to colleagues that, you know, where the marble floors are slightly dented, that was my feet that did that, you know, over the years. We've lived through so much change in this building and so much, you know, so much history that it's going to be sad. It's going to be sad, and I hope she gets a proper send-off, this building.
It was more than just a building. I think it was an organism in itself. I mean, every day the night shift would melt away as the sun came up. We'd often go and have cigarettes on the roof and watch the buildings of the Thames slowly become lit with the morning sun. The building would then stir into action as the first editors came in, the editorial meeting.
To be able to tune in to something like the World Service and hear this stuff coming out at you and giving you a shape to the world around you is unbelievable. It's like bringing colour into a dark room.
Goodbye to Bush House was presented by John Chuser and produced by Anna Horsbrough-Porter. The editor was Bridget Harney.
It's a historic occasion for us today. This is the last edition of From Our Own Correspondent, or FOOC as we call it, to be broadcast from Bush House in the Strand by Waterloo Bridge in London. The next time you'll hear us, we'll be putting together the programme in a shiny new building a couple of miles away. Bush House is also closing its doors to the BBC World Service. Its multilingual staff will be joining us across town at New Broadcasting House by Oxford Circus. Anna Horsbrough-Porter's been talking to some of those who've worked here during the 71 years that Bush House has broadcast to the world.
Since March, Bush House has gradually been emptying out. Region by region and floor by floor, the language services have been leaving. Now the move is almost complete and the building is silent and the lifts come unnervingly fast. The central newsroom is the last to leave, waiting until midday next Thursday when the final five-minute bulletin will be read from Bush House and then the switch will be complete. I've been recording the memories of those who worked in Bush House. Many of the interviews have taken place in the bowels of the building, in the old underground drama studio, which started life as a swimming pool when Bush first opened in 1925. One of the oldest memories came from Leonid Finkelstein, who worked in the Russian service for nearly 30 years, but he first heard the BBC in one of Stalin's labour camps in 1948. His fellow prisoner there was an engineer and managed to build a radio out of scraps of metal. One day he gave Leonid an earpiece, and that is how I first learnt about the Chelsea Flower Show in London, he said. Yuri Goligorsky also listened secretly as a child in Moscow. Every morning his father would close the windows to avoid detection and turn on the radio for the daily 6:45 a.m. Russian service broadcast. Yuri told us how his family would analyse what they'd heard. He told me, long conversation ensued after broadcast, perhaps 15 minutes of programme and 2 hours discussion followed. Years later, when Yuri worked in Bush House, whenever he sat down at a microphone to broadcast, he said he only ever had one listener in mind, always a picture of my dad. It was Yuri who masterminded one of the landmark broadcasts from Bush House. In 1988, he sent a letter to Downing Street asking if Mrs. Thatcher would take part in a live phone-in to Russia. It was the first time anything like it had been attempted. There was no direct dial to the UK from Russia. Every international call had to be booked through an operator. Yuri's sleepless nights ended in triumph, however. They had over 800 calls from Russia, so many so that the telephone exchange in Covent Garden was overloaded. The Daily Mail ran a cartoon about it, showing two burly prison guards at a salt mine somewhere in Siberia, dangling a scrawny dissident between them. The caption read, Was it you who booked a call to Mrs. Thatcher? Many of the stories told about Bush House centred on the canteen, the melting pot of the building. I remember it at lunchtimes as a kind of friendly but overwhelming babel, each table occupied by a different language service, all competing to be heard in the cavernous underground room. At its peak, the World Service was broadcasting in 45 different languages from Bush House, which allowed for some fairly niche specialisms. A Welsh service transmitting to Patagonia, and Portuguese for Jersey, targeting all the expat hotel staff who worked there. Graham Mitten, who was head of the Hauser section, remembers receiving letters addressed to the Queen, care of Bush House, and once a sole envoy from Hadejia in northern Nigeria arrived at reception asking for the Hauser service. He'd been sent by the Emir to buy hospital equipment in the UK, and on landing at Heathrow, only knew one building in London to go to. Graham took him on to the Department of Trade. Now, as I get ready to leave Bush House myself, it's the sounds from the building which will stick in my memory. The female voice in the lifts announcing each floor in her peculiar but very familiar clipped tones. Lily Bolero, the World Service's signature tune, originally an Irish jig by Purcell, played so many times that it must be impregnated in the walls by now. And finally, the noises from the Strand, which so often came in through the windows as we worked, the traffic and sirens, but also the frequent demonstrations and noisy gatherings outside. Bush House is on one of the main arteries into Trafalgar Square, and we'd often stop work to peer down at the protesters marching past, shouting their slogans. After so many years and so many millions of spoken words broadcast from Bush House, now it waits in limbo for its new future, still filled with the ghosts and voices of the past.
Anna Horsbrough-Porter at Bush House, a building many are sad to leave. And that's it. We're back next Saturday after moving house. Do join us. Goodbye.
I'm Julian Marshall, and this is the last edition of News Hour to be broadcast from Bush House, the building the BBC World Service has been based in for more than 70 years, since a bomb damaged our previous headquarters broadcasting house during the Second World War in 1941. The building has been leased from a Japanese bank, and no one seems quite sure what will happen to it now the BBC is moving out, whether it'll be offices or a hotel or part of a university. But although you might not notice the difference between our broadcasts from Bush House and those coming from the building we're moving to on Monday, New Broadcasting House, this is something of a milestone, and inevitably questions are being asked as to whether it'll eventually be seen as the end of a World Service era. In any case, here's a sense of a building that seems to exercise such a hold on the imagination.
Don't expect too much in the early days. For some time we shall transmit comparatively simple programmes. The programmes will neither be very interesting nor very good.
Good morning, Africa!
This is the BBC in Beijing.
Reykjavik.
Sofia. Delhi.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.
It's a very classically inspired building, built in the 1920s by an architect, an American architect called Harvey Corbett. Now, this is really interesting about Bush House is that he was an American, but it's obviously been inspired by classical Italian Greek architecture, which is what we can see here. I think what I like best is that moment when you're having to approach Bush House across this sea of traffic. And you have to make a real effort to get to it. And once you're there, you have this sort of moment of reflection before you go into the main reception. And it's exactly like a temple. And in fact, in ancient Greece, those sorts of spaces, the porch of Bush House, you would have found attached to the Stoa, a place for conversation, a place for thinking. So I think it's rather appropriate and rather wonderful that all the visitors that come to Bush House go through the Exedra.
Favourite memories are of
when I was on night shifts, walking through the building, going between studios, between my bookings, and singing in the stairwell.
One morning in May 1941, I arrived at my office and it had gone. A bomb had fallen nearby. From then on, we were all in Busch House. Space there was restricted and life extremely chaotic. But it was a very exhilarating experience nevertheless, for here, assembled by the chances and vicissitudes of war, was a real microcosm of European intellectual life.
Here we are standing in the very fine cream marble sort of central foyer of Busch House. And by 1941, it was completely brimming with, you know, exotic foreigners. There were lots of Hungarians and Czechs, and, you know, every conceivable language. And, of course, these exotic foreigners brought with them their own mores. And there was also an awful lot of young women who started to work for the World Service. And the Hungarians, it was long noticed, did not ascribe to the same niceties as British people when they were chatting up girls. So in this foyer, a duel took place between a Hungarian and, as I recall, a Czech, as a matter of honour, about the affections of a young woman. And there's a wonderful BBC memo from the period sort of saying, we didn't know it was going to happen and we certainly wouldn't have allowed it to happen if we had known it was going to happen. But it did resolve a long-term affair of the heart.
The French are glad to die for love. They delight in fighting duels. But I prefer a man who lives and gives Expensive.
J'invite tous les Français qui veulent rester libres à m'écouter et à me suivre. Vive la France, libre dans l'honneur et dans l'indépendance.
But won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you.
Now we're going into the BBC canteen. In the past, that kind of constant chewing over what's going on in places, plus culture, would have been going on around here with the steam of the teapots and the steam of the coffee being made over there. And in fact, coffee was introduced to the World Service canteen at a higher standard earlier than the main canteen because the Eastern Europeans really said, we cannot tolerate the coffee. This is how you do it.
I've been working here for 15 years at Busch House. We have met a lot of people here. Actually, the Busch House sounds like a small UN. We have people from different languages. We exchange with each other. We talk with each other. We have party with each other.
BBC London. এখন গ্রিনিচ মান সময় বিকেল 4:40.
One of my colleagues, she's no more now. She died in 2008. Whenever I go there, it reminds me of her. Somehow, I don't want to leave, you know. It's as if I've left a part of me at Busch House.
I would say there's something about the building that brings out the best in people. And it's a very warm building. It's a building with a lot of heart, and it brings out a lot of love in people. And it sounds corny, but it really does.
They all have different stories and they all have different takes. It's amazing how different one person can be from another, you know. I mean, Bennett Jones, you know, he loves talking to the officials and getting things done, and I mean, it's fantastic. And his red socks. Everybody loves.
I remember growing up in Ghana during the struggle for independence, the almost ever-present hum of the announcers and the suspenseful silence that will descend on parents and teachers alike at the approach of the latest headlines. The BBC was a constant presence at home and at school. Even today, to hear that trademark series of beeps signaling the top of the hour, and for us to hear the headlines is to hear humankind awakened, informed, empowered.
So many sounds, so many memories, more than 70 years of the World Service at Bush House. And what I'll remember most is the warmth, conviviality and informality of this building where I've worked for 37 years and the dedication of my colleagues past and present. I'll miss Bush House terribly. But however strong the pull is, it's time to move on. NewsHour's back on air at 12 hours GMT on Monday from New Broadcasting House. The team on this last edition of the programme from Bush House, Lyndall, Junaid, Mehta, James, Darren and Bogdan. From them and from me, Julian Marshall, goodbye.
We close with a promo CD produced to promote BBC World Service programmes to radio stations in North America as satellite relays became possible in the 1990s. A very familiar voice gives us an overview of the wide range of programmes emanating from Bush House.
Hello and welcome. I wonder how many times I've said that over the years. This is John Tidmarsh, presenter of the BBC World Service programme Outlook, and I can tell you I've seen some changes since Outlook first came on the air nearly 30 years ago. But some things never change. The BBC World Service built its reputation on editorial independence, accuracy and global coverage. And those core values haven't altered, whether we're broadcasting current affairs or the latest pop news. We now broadcast to 130 million listeners in 41 languages from state-of-the-art studios. We're rescheduling some of our programmes to suit you. Our American rebroadcast is rather better. You can choose from classical or contemporary music, world-class drama, human interest programmes, or, of course, our unrivalled international news, available every hour, every day of the year.
Under the campsign entrance gates, which still bear the Nazi inscription, "Work makes you free," delegates held a minute of silence in honour of those who died here. The somber group proceeded, again in silence.
People used to tell their story in an extraordinary way. They would take hold of your hands, and you would have these very thin hands and arms clutching you and rasping their story, almost like a vomit of some horror that had to be recounted and recounted.
Israeli flags and those of other nations fluttered in the wind as a hymn sung by Catholic priests was followed by the chanting of an imam in a ceremony uniting all creeds and nationalities in mourning and remembrance.
Moving reports and tributes from the 50-year commemoration services at Auschwitz. I'm Max Pearson, one of the regular presenters of NewsHour, and I remember the programme very clearly that day as our correspondent Carolyn Wyatt painted a sombre picture of those ceremonies. Over the years, many reports linger in the mind, like the day when the Russian deputies were finally forced out of the Parliament building at the end of their standoff with Boris Yeltsin. We covered it live, letting the world know that the crisis for the time being was over. NewsHour is the BBC's flagship live news and current affairs programme. 60 minutes of the world's headlines and the stories behind them, the context and the analysis of the news. Like all World Service programmes, NewsHour reflects the world to the world. And the world listens because, with over 60 years of international broadcasting experience, we are trusted as impartial, unbiased and accurate. It's a responsibility we don't take lightly. Our 250 correspondents worldwide file dispatches not just for NewsHour, but for our shorter news briefing news desk. Our newsroom here at Bush House in London compiles 5- and 10-minute bulletins on the hour every hour. International news that you can tailor to your schedule. And who listens? Well, when I think of a NewsHour listener, I cannot think of any single individual, because our audience covers the complete range, from peasant farmers in the developing world to Mikhail Gorbachev, who tuned in to find out if he'd been deposed in a coup, from the man in the street, literally, to the world's leaders. But news programmes aren't the only place where you'll hear the newsmakers.
One received many death threats. One of the most serious was when the Red Commando, the White Commando, said I had to be out of South Africa by such and such a date. I arranged my funeral and said, well, I mean, I don't want to die now, But who said death was the worst thing that could happen to a Christian?
That was Archbishop Desmond Tutu speaking out on the dangers of living in the old South Africa on Outlook last year. Hello, I'm Barbara Myers from Outlook, our topical daily magazine. Since I joined the programme, I've had the pleasure of talking to many hundreds of fascinating people. Travellers like Fiona Campbell, the young Englishwoman who walks across continents. Poets like Tatiana Tolstoya from Russia and Michael Ondaatje from Canada. And even princes, a truly memorable visit to Buckingham Palace. We have controversial debates about violence on television, women in the church, test tube babies, compassionate stories about the street children of Brazil or human rights abuses, special assignments, programmes live from anywhere and everywhere in the world, and of course celebrity guests from the world of show business, like Dudley Moore, Julie Andrews and Anthony Hopkins.
The very first scene I had to do with Catherine Hepburn, I was so nervous. And we did a camera rehearsal, and afterwards she said, come and have a coffee. So I went and had a coffee with her. She said, tell me something, do you like the camera? I said, what? She said, do you like the camera? I said, well, I suppose so. She said, why'd you play the whole scene with the back of your head to it? She said, you do that, I'll steal the scene from you. She said, now listen, keep your voice down, be still, don't act.
Anthony Hopkins. And it will be a long time before I forget looking into the eyes of Hannibal Lecter across a microphone. Do join me, or John Tidmarsh, each weekday for 25 minutes of human issues, events and people, live on Outlook. Now here's a man who discovers the world through music.
Hello, this is Andy Kershaw, presenter of the World Service's musical Globetrot, World of Music. Each week, I play exhilarating records from around the world, whether it's gospel from Alabama or guitar pyrotechnics from Kinshasa. Not everybody's cup of tea. Some people prefer blasts from the past. You can hear the blockbusters of yesteryear each week on the Vintage Chart Show. Or you could catch up on all the latest releases in Multitrack Hit List. Hear interviews with megastars like Mariah Carey, R.E.M., Salt-N-Pepa, The Rolling Stones in Multitrack Express. Or take a trip to the cutting edge of pop with Multitrack Alternative. Hit. And then there's my old friend Dr. Excitement, the inimitable John Peel with, well, John sort of music. Music from everywhere, for everyone. Of course, some people would rather settle down with a good book or a good play or...
Roughing stretches, roughing pitches. Lone outside, ball three. I told that boy 109 times.
Eugene, stop banging the wall!
Max Cosella and Valerie Harper having a typical family spat in Neil Simon's Brighton Beach Memoirs, one of our recent BBC World Service Plays of the Week. I'm Gordon House, the head of the drama unit, and as you'll gather from that cast list, we're not confined to a staple diet of British classics. In the last 2 years, I've been over to the studios of KCRW Santa Monica, recording plays with such big Hollywood names as Sharon Gless, Catherine Helmond, Ed Asner and Michelle Pfeiffer. Well, actually, no, I'm lying about Michelle Pfeiffer. But who knows, she's a great actress, and I have a hunch she'd look rather good in front of a radio microphone. And I'm really very keen to work with her. Well, here in London, we have no trouble persuading some of Britain's greatest actors to come to the drama studio in Bush House. A few weeks ago, you might have run into Sir John Gielgud and Dame Wendy Hiller recording a bittersweet play by James Prideaux about families surviving the trauma of old age. Ian Holm, Dame Maggie Smith, Jeremy Irons, Judy Dench, Ian Richardson, Geraldine McEwan, they and many other major actors have enjoyed the challenge of making plays live in a medium where words and sounds paint all the pictures. And as for the plays themselves, well, they range from the purely entertaining through to the world's major classics, bolstered by contemporary challenging pieces by younger dramatists. Harold Pinter, Tom Stoppard and John Mortimer all cut their professional teeth by writing radio plays. Stoppard's latest stage play, Indian Ink, which has just opened in London, was developed from a recent BBC radio drama. And some of tomorrow's major writers will have been heard first on radio. In April, in our Globe Theatre season, we're showcasing some of our new, bright, younger writing talents, such as Hattie Naylor, Steve Walker and Louise Page. There'll also be chances to hear radio adaptations of plays by Alan Ayckbourn, Christopher Hampton, Wally Schoenker, Terence Rattigan, Ibsen, Chekhov, and a chap we're quite proud of here in England called William Shakespeare. We're running a play competition to attract new international writers and listeners. And, yes, I'm hoping to travel over to the studios of KCRW Santa Monica again to record two more American plays with all-star Hollywood casts. Who knows? Perhaps this is the year I'll work with Michelle Pfeiffer.
From London, BBC Caribbean Report.
Hello, I'm Debbie Ransom of BBC's Caribbean Service. Our flagship programme, Caribbean Report, can be heard Mondays to Fridays at 21:15 GMT. In a fast-moving 15 minutes, we seek out news, views and analysis of the events that matter. We take you from the decision-makers in Washington.
Whether Mr. Castro leaves Cuba in a vertical position or a horizontal position doesn't matter to me. That's up to him. And that's up to the Cuban people. But he will leave Cuba.
To the heart of the European Union.
There is concern over the implications of liberalization for countries, whether in the Caribbean or elsewhere, that are heavily dependent upon single commodities, and in the case of bananas, for example, they are dependent on a single market within Europe.
We report on Britain's relationship with the region.
The Anglophone Caribbean is and always will be very important to us. After all, large numbers of Commonwealth colleagues are in the Caribbean, but as an exporting nation, we have to look to the whole of the world as our market.
And reflect the important developments taking place within the Caribbean itself.
We are paving the way for democracy in Haiti. This democracy will bring peace for all, reconciliation among all, respect and justice for every single citizen.
Naturally, sport is an important ingredient in the Caribbean Report mix.
And Lara, absolutely still at the crease, under his maroon West Indian cap, looking up towards Lewis. 365 not out, Lewis bowls to him, it's short, he hooks it, and he has broken the world individual test record with a hook for four to the mid-wicket boundary.
BBC Caribbean Service also reflects the achievements, lifestyles and ambitions of the diaspora in a weekly 15-minute programme, which is posted on cassette to subscriber stations. BBC Caribbean Magazine features discussion.
Black women seem to be going for a certain type of black male, OK? They don't want the ordinary guy. No, they want the R. Kelly kind of type, don't they? The guy who, like, has his trousers down around his knees and showing off his underpants.
And lots of money.
Yeah, and doing bump and grind every couple of days
flash
or whatever.
Yeah,
they want this kind of guy. That's what they go after.
No, I don't think so. I think what it is, okay, even if you're right, Patrick, and it's not that women should be putting can't in their vocabulary, I think it's a case of women don't know where to find them, even if they can't. It's not just the fact they can't find them. They don't know where to look for them in the first place.
They've got cars, man. They know where to. They can go and find them. It's not like the olden days when a woman's trapped in a house.
BBC Caribbean Magazine also features personalities and music.
Then from me it slipped one day.
In the many hundreds of interviews Bob Marley probably gave in his lifetime, he rarely spoke about his racial identity or his private life. Occasionally, though, he did shed some light on his past.
Born fatherless, never knew my father. My mother worked 30 shillings a week to keep me, go to school, right? We don't have education, we have inspiration. If I was educated, I would be a damn fool.
And much more. BBC Caribbean Report and BBC Caribbean Magazine at the cutting edge of Caribbean communication.
Broadcasting to the world, that's what we aim to do. And from me, John Tidmarsh, for the moment, goodbye.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website. where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.